8. Fraffin glared at the image projected above his desk. It was Lutt, his master of craft, a broad-faced chem, steely-skinned, harsh and abrupt in his decisions, lacking subtlety. He combined all the best qualities for one who supervised the mechanical end of this work, but those very qualities interfered with his present assignment. He obviously equated subtlety with caution. A moment of silence served to acquaint Lutt with the director's displeasure. Fraffin felt the contour pressures of his chair, glanced at the silvery web of the pentavive across the salon. Yes, Lutt was like that instrument. He had to be activated correctly. Fraffin ran a finger along his jaw, said, "I didn't tell you to spare the immune. You were directed to bring the female here at once." "If I have erred, I abase myself," Lutt said. "But I acted on the basis of past directives concerning this immune. The way you gave his female to another, the way you—" "He was an amusing diversion, no more," Fraffin said. "K. Lexel has asked to examine a native, and he has mentioned this female specifically by name. She is to be brought here at once, unharmed. That proviso doesn't apply to any other native who tries to interfere or delay you in the execution of this order. Am I understood?"
"The director is understood," Lutt said. There was fear in his voice. Lutt knew the possible consequences of Fraffin's displeasure. Dismissal from a position of unlimited delights and diversions, from a life that never bored. He lived in a chem paradise, from which he could easily be shunted to some tertiary post, and with no recourse, because they shared the same guilt, he and Fraffin, the same guilt with its certain terrible punishment, if they were ever discovered. "Without delay," Fraffin said.
"She will be here before this shift is half spent," Lutt said. "I go to obey."
Lutt's image faded, disappeared. Fraffin leaned back. It was going fairly well, in spite of this delay. Imagine that Lutt trying to separate the lovers by manipulating their emotions. The clod must know the danger of trying that on an immune. Well, the female would be here soon, and Kalexel could examine her as he wished. Every tool and device to bend the native's will would be provided, of course, as a matter of courtesy. Let no one question the hospitality of Fraffin the director. Fraffin chuckled. Let the stupid investigator try the pleasures of this native. Let him impregnate the female. His flesh would know it when it was done. Accomplished breeding would accelerate his need for rejuvenation. And where could he turn? Could he go back to the primacy and say, "Rejuvenate me. I've produced an unlicensed child"? His flesh wouldn't permit that. No more than would the primacy with its hide-bound absolutes. Oh, no. Kalexel would know the story ship had its own rejuvenators, its own surgeon. He'd come begging, his mind telling him, "I can have as many children as I wish, and damn the primacy." Once he'd been rejuvenated, the story ship would own him. Again, Fraffin chuckled. They might even get back to the lovely little war in time to make a complete production out of it.
9. Ruth was surprised to find herself enjoying the anger that condensed the room around her. The frustrated emotion that had built up in her out there in the night with Andy had an outlet at last. She watched the nervous twisting of Nev's pink hands with their baby skin creases at the knuckles. She knew how his hands betrayed his feelings, no matter what the masked rest of him revealed. 8 months of living with the man had given her considerable knowledge. Words came out of her full lips now, like slivers of bamboo to be inserted beneath Nev's manicured soul. "Scream about your husband's rights all you want," she said. "The business is mine now, and I don't want you anywhere near it. Oh, I know why you married me. You didn't fool me for long, Nev. Not for long." "Ruth, you..." "No more! Andy's out there waiting for me. I'm going to take the few things I want here, and I'm leaving." Nev's wide, high forehead creased. The shoe-button eyes stared at her with their matched nothingness. On one of her rampages again, that's all. And enjoying it, damn her. I can tell by the way she shakes her head like a horse. Whores. Horse. Whores. A horsey, high-class whore. Ruth broke her gaze away from him. Nev frightened her when he stared that way. She studied the room, wondering if there were anything here she wanted now. Nothing. It was a Nev Hudson room with overlapping muted reds and browns, oriental bric-a-brac, a grand piano in one corner, a closed violin case that opened to reveal 3 bottles of liquor and a set of glasses. Nev liked that. "Let's get drunk and make beautiful music, honey." Windows beyond the piano stood uncurtained to the night, and garden lights, lawn, barbecue pit, wrought iron furniture standing whitely dripping after the rain. "California is a community property state," Nev said. "You'd better look into the law again," she said. "The business is my inheritance." "Inheritance?" he asked. "But your father's not dead yet." She stood staring at the night, refusing to let him goad her. "Damn her," he thought. "I should have done better in a woman, but not with a business thrown into the bargain. She's thinking about that bastard Andy Thurlow. She wants him, but she needs my brains running the business. That ugly stick of a boy man in her bed. She won't have him. I'll see to it. If you go away with this Dr. Thurlow, I'll ruin him professionally and I'll ruin you," he said. She turned her head sideways, presenting a Greek profile, the severe line of her red hair tied at the back. A barely perceptible smile touched her lips. It was gone. "Jealous, Nev?" "I've warned you." "You married me for the business," she said. "What do you care how I spend my time?" And she turned toward him. "Squirm, you little pig of a man. What was I thinking of? What was I ever thinking of to take you instead of Andy? Did something twist my emotions? Make me do it?" She felt suddenly weak with the hungry hating. "Is any choice ever right, right, right? Andy choosing that fellowship instead of me, his eyes full of innocence, so hateful. Where did I spend my innocence? Unthinking about animal bodies and power. Did I choose power in Nev? But he let me take it away from him, his own power, and now I can hate him with it." "The daughter of a murderer," he snapped. She glared at him. "Is this what I chose? Why? Lonely, that's why. All alone when Andy left me for that damned fellowship, and there was Nev, insistent, kind like a fox. Drunk, I was drunk and feeling hateful. Nev used my hate, that's the only power he had. Hate, my hate, I mustn't hate then, and he's powerless. I won't even hate him putting his hand on my knee, oh, so kind. So kind, and a little higher.
And there we were in bed, married, and Andy away in Denver, and I was still alone.
I'm going, she said. Andy's going to drive me over to Sarah's. If you try to stop me, I'll call him in, and I'm quite sure he can handle you.
Nev's narrow, purse-string mouth tightened. His shoe-button eyes betrayed a brief flaring, and then the mask was back in place.
I'll ruin them both. The bitch prattling about Andy, well, I showed dear old honest Andy, the boy with the built-in system of honor, and what would she say if she learned I was the one put on the pressure to get him that fellowship?
You know what the town'll think, he said. Like father, like daughter. They'll take my side. You know that.
She stamped her foot. You pig!
Certainly, Ruth, my dear. Get angry and stamp around like a wonderful animal. My God, would I like to take you to bed right now. Angry and hurting, throwing yourself and twisting and jerking. My God, you're splendid when you're angry. I'm better for you than Andy, and you should know it. We're two of a kind. We take what we want, and damn the honor. No honor, no honor on her. On her, on her. What an animal when she's angry. But that's what life's for. To take, to take, and take, and take, until we're filled up on it. And she raves about Andy going back to him. But Andy doesn't take from me, no siree. I'll get rid of him just as easily as I did before, and Ruthie'll come crawling back to her ever-loving Nev, who knows her right down to her adorable, most angry, adorable, if I only had the guts to yank you into the bedroom right now. Well, I'd get rid of Andy, just like I did before.
We'll strike a bargain, he said. Go along with your lover. But don't interfere with how I run the business.
You said it yourself. What do I care how you spend your time? Go ahead. Compromise yourselves, he thought. I'll own you.
She whirled away, strode down the hall, jerked open the bedroom door, snapped on the light. Nev was right behind her. He stood in the doorway watching as she yanked clothes from drawers and the closet, threw them on the bed.
Well, what about it? He asked.
She forced words out of her mouth, knowing they told more than she wanted to reveal.
All right. Keep the business. Or whatever. We know what's precious to you.
She turned to face him, near tears and fighting to hide it.
You're the most hateful creature I've ever met. You can't be human.
She put a hand to her mouth.
I wonder if you are.
Was that supposed to...
He broke off, stared past her toward the French doors onto the patio.
Ruth!
Her name came out in a strangled gasp. She whirled. The French doors stood open to reveal three squat figures clothed in green moving into the room. To Ruth, their heads seemed strangely large, the eyes faintly luminous and frightening. They carried short tubes of silvery metal. There was a disdainful sense of power in the purposeful way they fanned out, pointing those metal tubes casually at the bedroom's occupants. Ruth found herself wondering, with an odd feeling of surprise, how they'd opened the French doors without her hearing it. Behind her, Nev gasped, said,
"See here, who?"
His voice trailed off in a frightening hiss, an exhalation as though he were a punctured balloon. A liquid trilling sound poured from the mouth of the creature on Ruth's right.
"This can't be happening," she thought.
Then,
"They're the creatures who frightened us in the grove. What do they want? What are they doing?"
She found suddenly that she couldn't move. Her head felt detached, mind clear, but there were no connections to her body.
One of the creatures moved to stand directly in front of her. A queer little manling in green leotards, his torso partly concealed in a cloudy, bulging roundness that pulsed with a purple inner light. She remembered Andy's description of what he'd seen. Glowing eyes. Andy! She wanted to scream for him, but her voice wouldn't obey. How drifting and soft the world seemed. Something jerked past her, and she saw Nev there, walking as though pulled by strings. Her eyes focused on a smudge of powder along his shoulder, a pulsing vein at his temple. He tipped forward suddenly in that strange marionette way, falling rigidly into one of the open French doors. There came the crash and tinkling of broken glass. The floor around him became bright with flowing red. He twitched, lay still. The gnome creature in front of her spoke quite distinctly in English. "An accident, you see." She had no voice to answer, only a distant horror somewhere within the powdery billowing that was herself. Ruth closed her eyes, thinking, "Andy, oh Andy, help me." Again she heard one of the creatures speak in that liquid trilling. She tried to open her eyes, couldn't. Waves of darkness began to wash over what remained of her awareness. As unconsciousness came, her mind focused clearly on a single, oddly pertinent thought. This can't be happening, because no one would believe it. This is nightmare. That's all. 10. Thurlow sat in the dark car smoking his pipe, wondering what was taking Ruth so long in the house. "Should I go in after all?" he asked himself. "It isn't right that I stay out here while she's in there alone with him." But she said she could handle him. Did Adele think she could handle Joe? That's a crazy thought. It was raining again. A thin drizzle that misted the streetlight at the corner in front of him. He turned, glanced at the house. Lights in the living room, but no sign of movement behind the drawn shades. "When she comes to the door, I'll go up and help her carry whatever." No. Damn it, I should go in now. But she must know if she can handle him. Handle him. What was it like, those two? Why did she marry him? He shook his head, looked away from the house. The night appeared too dark beyond the streetlights, and he eased off the setting on his polarizing lenses. What was keeping her in there? He thought suddenly of the hovering object he'd seen at the grove. There must be some logical explanation, he thought. Perhaps if I called the Air Force, anonymously. Somebody must have a simple, logical explanation. But what if they haven't? My God. What if the saucer nuts turn out to have been right all along? He tried to see his wristwatch, remembered it hadn't been wound. Damn, she was taking a long time in there. Like a train shunted onto an odd track, his mind veered to a memory of Ruth's father. The compelling directness of the man's eyes. "Take care of Ruthie." And that thing hovering at Joe's window. What had that been? Thurlow took off his glasses, polished them with a handkerchief, slipped them back on his nose. He remembered Joe Murphy in April, right after the man had turned in the false fire alarm. What a shock it had been to find Ruth's father facing him in the dirty little examination room above the sheriff's office. And there'd been the even greater shock at evaluating the man's tests. The dry language of his report to the probation office couldn't begin to convey that shock. "I found him to be a man lacking a good central core of balanced feelings. This, coupled to a dangerous compulsive element such as the false fire alarm, should be considered a warning of serious disturbance. Here is a man whose psychological makeup contains all the elements necessary for a terrible tragedy. The language of the report, so careful in its wording, maintaining the strict esoterica of officialese, he'd known how little it might convey, and had supplemented it with a verbal report. The man's dangerous. He's a definite paranoid type and could explode. He's capable of violence. The disbelief had been frightening. Surely this is nothing more than a prank. Joe Murphy? Hell, he's an important man here, Andy. Well, could you recommend analysis? Psychoanalysis. He won't have anything to do with it, and I doubt it'd do him any good. Well, what do you expect us to do? Can't you recommend something? Maybe we can get him into a church. I'll call Father Giles at the Episcopal Church and see if... A church? Thurlow remembered his rueful shrug, the two pat words. I'll probably be read out of the order for this, but religion often does what psychology can't. Thurlow sighed. Father Giles, of course, had been unsuccessful. Damn, what was keeping Ruth in that house? He reached for the car door, thought better of it. Give her a few more minutes. Everything was quiet in there. Probably it was taking her time to pack. Ruth. 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 He remembered that she'd taken his probation report with better balance than the officials, but she was trained in his field, and she'd suspected for some time that her father was disturbed. Thurlow remembered he'd gone out to the hospital immediately after the session in the probation office. Ruth had accompanied him, looking withdrawn and fearful, into the almost deserted cafeteria. They'd taken their cups to a corner table. He remembered the steam table smell of the place, the faint antiseptic background, the marbleized linoleum tabletop with its leftover coffee stains. Her cup had clattered in a trembling staccato as she'd put it down. He'd sat silently for a moment, sensing her need to come to grips with what he'd told her. Presently, she'd nodded. Then,
I knew it, I guess.
Ruth, I'll do everything.
No.
She tucked a strand of red hair under her cap.
They let him call me from the jail, just before you came. He was furious with you. He won't accept anything you say.
They must have told him about my report, Thurlow thought. Now he knows his mask of sanity isn't working, he said. Of course he's furious.
Andy, are you sure?
She put her hand on his, her palm damp with perspiration. He held her hand, thinking of mingled perspiration. The idea carried an odd sense of intimacy.
You're sure,
she sighed.
I've seen it coming.
Again, that deep sigh.
I didn't tell you about Christmas.
Christmas?
Christmas Eve. I came home from the hospital. I had the late shift then, remember? He was walking around talking to himself, saying horrible things about Mother. I could hear her upstairs in her room, crying. I guess I screamed at him, called him a liar.
She took two quick breaths.
He hit me, knocked me into the Christmas tree. Everything knocked over.
She put a hand to her eyes.
He'd never hit me before. Always said he didn't believe in spankings. He'd had so many beatings when he was a boy.
Why didn't you tell me?
I was ashamed of... I thought if...
She shrugged.
I went out to the clinic and saw Dr. Welly, but he said fights, people in the conflict of marriage are...
Sounds like him. Did your mother know he hit you?
She heard him storm out and slam the door. He didn't come back all night. Christmas Eve. She'd heard the commotion. She came down, helped me clean up the mess. I wish I'd known this when I was talking to him. What good would it do? Everyone defends him, even Mother. You know what she said while she was helping me clean up? Your father's a very sick man, Ruthie. Defending him.
What about your neighbor, Sarah French? She and Dr. French heard the fights. Sarah knows Daddy's sick. Dr. French. Ruth shrugged. But as long as she knows, maybe... She doesn't mean mental illness. Dr. French thinks he has a progressive sclerotic condition, but Daddy won't go into the hospital for a complete examination. She knows about that, and that's what she meant. That's all she meant.
Ruth. He thought about this revelation for a moment. Ruth, severe conditions of this kind, Munchberg's sclerosis, for example, frequently are accompanied by personality distortions. Didn't you know this? He wouldn't cooperate, go to a hospital or anything. I talked to Dr. French. Well, he was no help at all. I warned Mother. The violence and...
Perhaps if she'd...
They've been married 27 years. I can't convince her he really might harm her.
But he struck you. Knocked you down.
She said I provoked him. Memories. Memories. An antiseptic little corner of the hospital cafeteria, and it was fixed in his memory now as indelibly as was this dark street outside the house where Ruth had lived with Nev. The warnings about Joe Murphy had been plain enough, but the world wasn't yet prepared to understand and protect itself from its own madness. Again he looked at the silent house, the glow of lights through the rain. As he looked, a woman in a glistening raincoat came running out between Ruth's house and the one on the left. For an instant he thought it was Ruth, and he was half out of the car before the streetlight hit her, and he saw it was an older woman with a coat thrown on over a robe. She wore slippers that squished wetly as she crossed the lawn. "You there!" she called, waving at Thurlow. Thurlow came fully out of the car. The rain was cold in his hair, on his face. He felt overcome with foreboding. The woman came panting up to him, stopped with the rain running down out of her gray hair.
"Our telephone's out," she said. "My husband's run across to the Inessis to use theirs, but I thought maybe all the phones are out, so I came."
"Why do you need a phone?"
The words sounded hoarse even to him.
"We live next door,"
she pointed.
"I can see from our kitchen across the patio into the Hudson's, and I saw him lying there, so I ran over. He's dead."
"Ruth. Mrs. Hudson?"
"No, Mr. Hudson. I saw her come in a while ago, but there's no sign of her around. We've got to call the police."
"Yes, yes, of course."
He started toward the house.
"She's not in there, I tell you. I ran all through the house."
"Maybe. Maybe you missed."
"Mister, there's been a terrible accident. Maybe she's already gone for help."
"Accident?"
He turned, stared back at her.
"He fell into one of them glass doors. Cut an artery, looks like. She probably ran for help."
"But I was out here, and..."
A police cruiser came around the corner to his left, its red light flashing. It pulled to a stop behind his car. Two officers got out. Thurlow recognized one of them. Maybach, Carl Maybach. a slim, angular man with bony wrists, narrow face. He came loping across the lawn to Thurlow while his companion went to the woman.
"Oh, Dr. Thurlow," Maybeck said. "Didn't recognize you."
He stopped, facing Thurlow.
"What's the trouble?" "We got a call, something about an accident. Ambulances on the way."
"The woman there," Thurlow nodded toward her, "says Nev Hudson's dead. Something about falling into some glass. She may be mistaken.
Shouldn't we get inside and—"
"Right away, Doc." Maybeck led the way, running up to the front door. It was locked.
"Around the side," the woman called from behind them. "Patio doors are open."
They ran back down the steps, around the side, wet leaves of shrubbery soaking them. Thurlow felt himself moving in a daze.
"Ruth, my God, where are you?"
He skidded on the wet bricks of the patio, almost fell, righted himself, and was staring down at the red mess that had been Nev Hudson. Maybeck straightened from a brief examination of the man.
"Dead, all right."
He looked at Thurlow. "How long you been here, Doc?"
"He brought Mrs. Hudson about half an hour ago."
It was the neighbor woman. She came to a stop beside Thurlow.
"He's dead, isn't he?"
How delighted she sounded.
I've been waiting in the car,"
Thurlow said.
"That's right,"
the woman said.
"We saw them come up.
Expected another fight between Hudson there and his missus. I heard the crash, him falling, but I was in the bathroom. I came right out to the kitchen."
"Did you see Mrs. Hudson?" Maybeck asked.
"She wasn't anywhere around. There was a lot of smoke coming out these doors here, though. He may have burnt something. He drank a lot, Mr. Hudson. May have been trying to open the doors for the smoke, and—"
She pointed to the body. Thurlow wet his lips with his tongue. He was afraid to go in that house, he realized. He said, "Hadn't we better look inside?"
"Perhaps."
Maybeck met his stare.
"Yes, perhaps we had better."
They could hear an ambulance siren now. It wailed to silence out front. The other officer came around the house, said,
"Ambulance is here, Carl. Where?"
He saw the body.
"Tell him not to disturb any more than they have to," Maybeck said. "We're going to look around inside."
The other officer peered suspiciously at Thurlow. "This is Dr. Thurlow," Maybeck said.
"Oh."
The officer turned to direct men in white coming around the house. Maybeck led the way inside. Thurlow was caught immediately by the sight of Ruth's clothing thrown on the bed. His chest felt tight, painful. The neighbor woman had said Ruth wasn't here, but— Maybeck stooped, peered under the bed. He straightened, sniffed.
"You smell something, Doc."
Thurlow grew aware that there was an odd odor in the room, almost like burnt insulation.
"Almost smells like fire and brimstone," Maybeck said.
"Probably was something burned in here." He glanced around. There was an empty ashtray on a nightstand. It was clean. He looked in the closet, went into an adjoining bath, returned, shaking his head. Thurlow went out to the hall, looked down it toward the living room. Maybeck brushed past him, led the way into the room. He moved cautiously, but with a practiced sureness, peered into the hall closet, behind a davenport. He touched only what he had to touch for his investigation. They progressed through the house this way, Thurlow a hesitant onlooker, fearful of what they might find around the next corner. Shortly, they were back in the bedroom. The ambulance doctor stood in the door, smoking. He glanced at Maybeck.
"Not much we can do here, Carl. Coroner's on his way."
"What's it look like?" Maybeck asked. "Was he pushed?"
"Looks like he stumbled," the doctor said. "Carpet's pushed up there by his feet. Can't say much about his condition at the time, but there's a smell of whiskey on him."
Maybeck nodded. taking in the evidence. They could hear the other officer talking outside to the neighbor woman.
"I don't know what it was,"
she said, her voice rising. "It just looked like a big cloud of smoke. Steam, maybe. Or it could have been an insect bomb. Something white and smoky."
Thurlow turned his back on the door. He found he couldn't stand the sight of the sprawled body. Ruth wasn't in the house. No doubt of that. Insect bomb, he thought. White and smoky. He recalled the grove then, the hovering something which Ruth had seen as a cloud. Abruptly, he knew what had happened to her. She wouldn't have disappeared like this without some word to him. Something had intruded here and taken her away. It would explain the strange smell, the presence of the thing at the grove, the interest of those weird creatures with their glowing eyes. But why? He asked himself. What do they want? Then, this is crazy. She was here when Nev injured himself and she ran for help. She's at a neighbor's and she'll be back any moment. And his mind said, she's been gone a long time. She saw the crowd and now she's frightened, he told himself. There was a bustle of activity at the door behind him, the coroner and the police homicide squad. Maybeck came up beside Thurlow, said, Doc, they want you to come down to the station and make a statement.
Yes, he said. Of course.
Then, that's the homicide detail. Surely they don't think... Just routine, Doc, Maybeck said. You know that. It looks like he was drinking and stumbled, but Mrs. Hudson's not around. We have to make sure. You know.
I see.
He allowed himself to be led out the door past the still figure that had been Ruth's husband, past the men with tape measures and cameras and dusting brushes and coldly measuring eyes.
Ruth's husband. Ruth's husband.
The label boiled in his mind.
Where is she?
Did she break down and run away? But she isn't the type for that. She was under strain, yes, but...
What was that cloud the neighbor saw? What was that smell in the room?
They were outside then. The rain had stopped, but the shrubbery beside the house still drenched them. Porch lights were on across the street. People stood there staring. A white lab truck had been pulled into the driveway beside the house on the other side.
You know, Doc, Maybeck said, you really shouldn't drive at night with those dark glasses.
They're adjustable, Thurlow said. Not as dark as they look.
Ruth, where are you?
He wondered then. Did she push Nev? A fight? Did she think people would say, like father, like daughter? Did she run, not wanting to drag me into it?
You can ride with us, Maybeck said. We'll bring you back to your car later.
Yes.
He allowed himself to be eased into the back seat. Then, Ruth,
Mrs. Hudson, shouldn't someone be looking for...
We're looking for her, Doc, Maybeck said. We'll find her, never you worry.
Will you find her? Thurlow wondered. What was that thing at the grove? Looking at us, trying to manipulate our emotions. It was real. I know it was real. If it wasn't real, then I'm insane. And I know I'm not insane.
He looked down at his feet in the dim shadows behind the seat. They were soaking from the walk across the wet lawn.
Joe Murphy, he thought.
Joe knows he isn't insane. 11. Ruth awoke on something soft, soothing blue-gray light. She felt around her, a bed. Silky warm covers. She realized she was nude on the bed, but warm,
warm. Above her there was an oval shape full of glittering crystal facets. They changed colors as she watched. Green, silver, yellow, blue. They were soothing. Somewhere she knew there was something urgently demanding her attention. But it was a paradox. Her whole being told her the urgent thing could wait. She turned her head to the right. There was light from somewhere, but she couldn't determine its source. A light suddenly full of yellows, like remembered sunlight. It illuminated an odd room. A wall lined with what appeared to be books. A low oval table cluttered with strange golden shapes. Cubes, rectangular containers, a domed half-egg. There was a window with last night's blue blackness pushing against it. As she watched, the window became metallic white, and a face appeared there to look in at her. It was a big face, odd silvery skin with harsh angles and planes, the eyes sunken, penetrating. Ruth felt she should be frightened by that face, but she couldn't find the emotional response. The face disappeared, and the window became a view looking down onto a seashore, surf-battered cliffs, dripping rocks, sunlight. Again there was night's darkness in the scene, and she realized that the framed shape could not be a window. In front of it stood a wheeled stand holding an unevenly stacked, multi-banked shape like a surrealistic typewriter. A draft touched the left side of her body. It was the first cold thing she had experienced since awakening. She turned toward it, saw an oval door. It stood open, but iris leaves were sinking inward to seal it. Just inside the door stood a squat figure in green leotards, the face that had peered in at her. Somewhere within her there was a reaction which said, "This is a loathsome, bow-legged little man." The reaction refused to surface. The creature's wide, thick-lipped mouth opened. He said, "I am Kalexel." The voice was smooth. It went through her with a tingling sensation. His eyes traversed her body, and she recognized the intense maleness of the look, was surprised to find herself not repelled by it. This room was so warmly soothing. The crystal facets above her moved with such gentle beauty. "I find you very attractive," Kalexel said. "I do not remember ever being attracted thus, with such magnetism." He walked around the place where she lay. Ruth followed him with her eyes, watched him manipulate keys on the machine atop the wheeled stand. A delicious tremor ran through her, and she began to wonder what it would be like to have this strange creature, this Kalexel, as a lover. Distantly within her, she sensed a voice screaming, "No, no, no!" Slowly, the voice dimmed, grew silent. Kalexel came to stand over her. "I am of the Chem," he said. "Does this mean anything to you?" She shook her head. "No." Her voice was faint. "You have not seen a person such as myself before?" Kalexel asked. She remembered her last few minutes with Nev, the creatures in the doorway, and Andy. She knew there was something she should feel about Andy Thurlow, a deep and abiding emotion, but there was only a sisterly affection. "Dear Andy, such a sweet, dear person."
"You must answer me," Kalexel said. There was a deep feeling of power in his voice.
"I saw three at my house. Three who..."
"Ah, the three who brought you here," Kalexel said. But before that, had you seen any of us before that? She thought then of the grove, Andy's description. Kind, pleasant Andy. But she hadn't really seen such creatures there.
No,
she said. Kalexel hesitated, glanced at the telltales of the manipulator which controlled the native female's emotions. She was telling the truth. Still, it paid to be cautious. Then it means nothing to you that I am of the Kem? He asked.
What are the Kem?
She asked. A part of her was aroused now to intense curiosity. The curiosity struggled up through muddy waves of distraction to sit in her awareness and stare at Kalexel. What a gnome of a creature. What a sweet little gnome. It shall mean something, Kalexel said. You are very attractive to me. We Kem are kind to those who please us. You cannot go back to your friends, of course, not ever. There are compensations, however. It's considered an honor to serve the Kem.
Where is Andy?
Ruth wondered.
Dear, sweet Andy.
Very attractive, Kalexel murmured. Wondering at the force which moved him, Kalexel extended a knob-knuckled finger, touched her right breast. How resilient and lovely her skin. The finger moved gently up to the nipple, to her neck, her chin, her lips, her hair. Your eyes are green, Kalexel said. We Kem are very fond of green. Ruth swallowed. The caressing movement of Kalexel's finger filled her with excitement. His face dominated her vision. She reached up, touched his hand. How hard and virile the hand felt. She met the penetrating stare of his brown eyes. The manipulator's instruments told Kalexel that the female was now completely subjugated to his will. The realization stirred him. He smiled, exposing square, silvery teeth. I will have many questions for you, he said. Later. Ruth felt herself sinking into a golden daze. Her attention was locked onto the crystal facets glittering above the bed. Kalexel's head momentarily obscured the kaleidoscopic movement. Then she felt his face pressed between her breasts. The golden daze overwhelmed her with ripples and waves of terrifying ecstasy.
Oh, God,
she whispered.
Oh, God. Oh, God!
How pleasant to be worshipped at such a moment, Kalexel thought. It was the most pleasure he had ever experienced from a female.